Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the University, I extend to you a very warm welcome to this evening's Sir Robert Menzies Oration on Higher Education, which is one of the most important events in the University's calendar. And I also extend a welcome to you to the special graduation ceremony, which is to be held in that context. I can tell you as an aside that the storm is in Geelong at the moment, and hopefully it'll arrive and pass before we have to leave this hall. But I extend a particular welcome to the Vice-Chancellor, Professor Glenn Davis, who is to be the orator this evening, the Chairman of the Menzies Foundation, Sir Guy Green, and its Executive Director, Professor John Matthews. Now, I begin in a customary way by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, who are the traditional owners of the land on which this ceremony will take place, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. As you may have noted from the material, the Sir Robert Menzies Oration was established in 1991 by the Sir Robert Menzies Memorial Foundation in conjunction with the university in recognition of Sir Robert's vision of the importance of the role in Australia of higher education and the development of universities in that context. Each oration is a contribution to the intellectual debate in Australia, and we look forward to hearing our Vice-Chancellor a little later. But as I've indicated, this evening is also a graduation, albeit one limited to conferring doctoral degrees and related prizes on the graduates whose names and respective citations are in the material that you have. Sir Robert, as Chancellor of this university, also conferred doctoral degrees, and the robes that you see me wearing this evening are the very robes that he wore on those occasions. And it is because this evening involves a graduation that the university mace is carried and members of the academic profession are robed. It is also appropriate to mention, I think, that the important values that are formalised by this ceremony are essentially the same as those of other universities of the same tradition and academic standard, and they've remained almost unchanged in essential respects from our first ceremony over 150 years ago. Primarily, the ceremony reflects important values such as academic freedom, fearless inquiry, and an uncompromising quest for excellence. To those about to be awarded doctorates, I congratulate you on behalf of the university on your significant achievements, which are summarily described in the abridged citations in this evening's program. The occasion marks for you an end to a very difficult journey, but also the beginning of what no doubt will be an exciting future, albeit one that will continue to require considerable work on your part. You've obtained these impressive qualifications through your hard work, capacity to focus on your goals, and no doubt because of your inherent ability. But I would urge you never to forget the contribution that this university and many others have made to your achievements, and also your high qualifications have placed upon you the very important responsibility of giving service and leadership that the community is entitled to expect of you. I mention a very practical matter to you. As one of our graduates, you will remain part of us, and as far as we can, we'll keep in touch. But to do this, we must know where you are, so please keep us in touch with your up-to-date addresses. And I would also encourage you to keep in touch through your respective alumni groups and their events here and in other parts of the world, and through the wide range of functions that are organised at the university throughout the year. There are over 250,000 Melbourne alumni in over 140 countries, so there is considerable opportunity to connect with them. Turning to those here to share the occasion with graduates closest to them, I extend the university's thanks for the support that you've given them during the years of study and strain. In many respects, it is a shared journey and can often be a time of great pressure and tension, but when it is successfully over, the celebrations belong to all who have been involved. So to you, who are here supporting one of the graduates as either as a parent, a partner, or another close relative or good friend, I would like to say thank you on behalf of the university and emphasise importantly that this occasion is also a tribute to you. Ladies and gentlemen, I invite you to sit back and enjoy the conferring of the doctorates, particularly to those closest to you, and the Menzies Oration. Thank you.
Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, Mr. Robert Menzies, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Menzies Foundation, I'd like to add my welcome to you all to this, the 19th Menzies Oration on Higher Education. And on behalf of the Foundation, I'd also like to extend my congratulations to all those upon whom degrees have been conferred this afternoon and the recipients of the Chancellor's Awards. Sir Robert Menzies retired in 1966 as Australia's longest serving and one of its most distinguished Prime Ministers. In reflecting on his achievements, Sir Robert considered that his contribution to the development of universities in Australia would prove to be amongst the most enduring and the most important. In recognition of his vision and leadership and in recognition of the significance of the role of higher education in Australia, the University of Melbourne and the Menzies Foundation established this Menzies Oration in 1991. It's especially fitting that these annual Menzies Orations are held in partnership with the University of Melbourne, where Robert Menzies, as he then was, as a leading law student, was president of the Students' Representative Council in 1916, and where, somewhat later in his life, he served as chancellor of this university. The Menzies Foundation has also honoured Sir Robert Menzies' contribution to education through a series of scholarships. With the Menzies Trust in London, we offer postgraduate scholarships in law and engineering. The Foundation also supports doctoral research in the allied health sciences in Australian universities. Other initiatives include a Menzies C.J. Martin Fellowship jointly with the NHMRC and a Menzies postgraduate scholarship to Harvard in association with the Harvard Club. Since 1979, the Foundation has expended over $23 million from its investment income to support young Australian achievers through its scholarships and through its investments in health research. The Foundation is also very proud of its three centres for health research. The Menzies School of Health Research in Darwin opened in 1984, and the Menzies Research Institute in Tasmania, which was established in 1988. Both are internationally recognised, highly regarded centres of excellence. A more recent initiative, the Menzies Centre for Health Policy, commenced in 2006 in partnership with the Australian National University and the University of Sydney. The annual Menzies Oration provides an opportunity for the Menzies Foundation and the University to join with their guests and the orator to celebrate excellence in higher education and reaffirm the fundamental significance of higher education in our society. It's also an occasion when it's appropriate to recognise that without new investment in higher education, Australia will not have the skills to be internationally competitive through the 21st century. Perhaps more importantly, we need to recognise that our universities need greater support in order to equip our young people to lead meaningful and productive lives and to provide leadership in a time of continuing change and global uncertainty. Despite bipartisan goodwill, we have to acknowledge that it's been challenging for recent Australian governments to make substantial new investments in higher education, and that in times such as these, we also need to look for leadership from the university sector itself. Today, we're most fortunate that the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, Professor Glyn Davis, a recognised leader in higher education in Australia, has agreed to deliver this year's Menzies Oration. I know we're all looking forward to hearing from her, from him. Chancellor, I'd like to thank the University of Melbourne for once again joining the Foundation for the presentation of this important oration.
Thanks to Guy Green on behalf of the University for your address about the work of the Menzies Foundation, and in particular the joining with the University and partnering it in so many fields in higher education and beyond. It is now a great pleasure to introduce the Vice Chancellor of the University, Professor Glenn Davis, who has kindly agreed to deliver this evening the 19th Menzies Oration. He is, and he probably will not thank me for saying this, a leading and very much respected leader in higher education in Australia, having served as Vice Chancellor of Griffiths University from 2002 to 2009, and as Vice Chancellor of this university from 2005. Professor Davis was educated in political science at the University of New South Wales and the Australian National University before undertaking postdoctoral appointments as a Harkness Fellow, the University of California, Berkeley, the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., and the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Professor Davis has also worked at length in the public sector, including service as the Director General of the Department of Premier and Cabinet in Queensland from 1998 to 2002, and from 2002 to 2006, he also served as Foundation Chair of the Australia and New Zealand School of Government. Professor Davis is a Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia and a Companion in the Order of Australia. He has served a term as Chair of the Group of Eight Universities representing Australia's leading research universities, and is now on the board of Universities Australia, made up of the Australian Vice Chancellors. Internationally, Professor Davis serves as a Vice Chair of Universitas 21, a group of 25 leading universities from around the globe, and is an active participant in the forums of the Association of Pacific Rim Universities. Given his unique experience, it is not surprising that Professor Davis is also a widely sought-after commentator in the higher education sector, a profile reflected in the recent invitation from the ABC to deliver the prestigious 2010 Boyer Lectures. Those who work closely with Glenn know that despite a busy schedule, the University of Melbourne is uppermost in his mind, a fact to be reflected in tonight's Menzies Oration. It gives me great pleasure, therefore, to call on him to deliver the oration, so please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in welcoming Professor Davis.
Chancellor, thank you for a most generous introduction. Previous Menzies orators, Professor David Pennington, Sir Guy Green, and Professor Richard Larkins, colleagues and friends, I thank Sir Guy and the Menzies Foundation, Memorial Foundation, for this invitation, and I'll try to get through it before the storm hits. As Sir Guy mentioned, at the retirement of an illustrious career in politics, Sir Robert Menzies became the 13th Chancellor of this university. And at each graduation ceremony during his chancellorship, he joined in the celebration of those who, like this afternoon, received doctoral degrees. Every person who we've just seen walking across this stage to collect a PhD carries in that gown not just years of hard work, but courage to find a topic, to propose a thesis, to dedicate a significant proportion of your life to testing that proposition is a brave decision. And women and men have been crossing this stage to collect doctorates at the University of Melbourne since 1948. Indeed, Melbourne was the first university to award this highest of tertiary qualifications, and among the first of the Australian universities to make research essential to its character. In doing so, Melbourne broke from received tradition. For the first century of tertiary education in this century, the purpose of a university, the sole purpose of a university, was teaching. Following British tradition, universities imparted knowledge and good character to their students. And this is reflected in The Idea of a University, written in late 1852 by Oxford graduate John Henry Newman. He was clear, knowledge is a worthwhile in itself, a liberal education to exercise the mind, reason and reflection, and therefore there could be no role, no place for research in a university. scientific and philosophic discovery he wrote are not appropriate for an institution focused on students. Now, even as Newman is sitting there in Oxford writing this now legendary book about the importance of universal knowledge, a bill before the Victorian legislature was creating the University of Melbourne. Its founders selected a coat of arms evoking wisdom under southern skies, and although they could never have read Newman, he hadn't published by the time the bill passed, they very much reflected the same thinking. They chose four professors who would teach the world of learning as they saw it: mathematics, classics, natural sciences, and modern history, full stop. That was the curriculum. Yet Melbourne was never destined to follow Newman's template as a place of contemplation, distant from the world. For a start, most of the students had no interest in living on campus. They had no interest in the sort of residential learning community that Newman was advocating. But more fundamentally, that original legislation assumed that the university would offer not just arts and science, but professional qualifications. Medicine, law, and music were just amongst the possibilities contemplated by the Victorian Parliament, and many more fields of professional study would follow as demand in the colony warranted. The university became known to its students as the shop, a pragmatic label reflecting an institution in which students travelling to campus each day studied the professions for their future careers. And those early patterns endured. The sandstone buildings, the beautiful south lawn might evoke the classic 19th century campus. We might work within the grammar of tradition, enjoy Latin tags, wear tasseled gowns, delight in elaborate ceremonies. Yet behind all of these symbols of continuity, purpose has shifted over time. A university can project an unchanging nature while quietly revising the most fundamental basis of its character. Thus, in the 1880s, the university consciously broke with its founding spirit by inviting two new groups onto campus. Women were originally confined to the Faculty of Arts, but by 1887, they were allowed into all faculties. Allowing research on campus proved equally controversial. The duty of a professor, said one council member in 1878, quote, is to impart, not invent. It would be another decade before the appointment of professors committed to research in chemistry and botany. These were important decisions, and the consequences took a long time to unfold. Indeed, it would take a century before female enrolments at the University of Melbourne equaled those of men. Today, women account for a majority of students in all but three faculties. And likewise, it would take decades to build the facilities and train the people essential to research. It has taken a long, slow transition for research to become central to the identity of this institution. And yet, of course, such sustained efforts have delivered impressive results. In 2010, Melbourne is the top-ranked Australian university as measured by research income, publications, citations, doctoral graduations. It is the largest research organisation in the country after the CSIRO. A university then is not fixed or immutable, despite appearances to the contrary. It can revisit its membership and its character. It can add women to the student's body. It can develop a whole new sense of purpose around research. Such change continues. Take biomedical research. This has become obviously a large and expensive activity. It requires teams of experts. And so the university can no longer by itself hope to host the expertise required. Instead, it must become the hub for a network of institutions. And its collaboration with brilliant partners, such as the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, the Bionic Ear Institute, the Royal Children's Hospital, amongst so many others, that makes possible the next generation of research. And this is the emerging pattern. Shared projects. Take the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre, now under construction on Grattan Street. The consortium of a university, research institutes and hospitals must together work to provide the largest combined clinical and research cancer centre in Australia. It's an approach already pioneered through partnerships that have created the Florey Neuroscience Institute and the Doherty Institute, which brings together some of Australia's preeminent immunologists. This is the next evolution of the university toward a model of co-production. Boundaries blur, staff work for a university and a research institute, funding is shared along with intellectual property and the platform infrastructure that make it possible. The University of Melbourne spills beyond its gates to embrace whole precincts through deep partnerships. From its origin as a controversial addition, research has become integral to our shared notion of what it means to be a university. This alteration has been slow, sometimes imperceptible. Research spent a century creeping from the margins to the centre of university life, and now it's shifting again before our eyes, sometimes so fast it can be a scramble to keep up. Of course, sometimes change is a matter of choice. And thus, in 2005, the University of Melbourne asked an unexpected, awkward question. Does it still make sense after 150 years to teach the professions as undergraduate programs? After all, in Australia, as in Britain, this challenges long-established practice. Students go straight from school into law or medicine, optometry or engineering, emerging qualified by their early 20s for a life of practice. This is an approach with many advantages. It keeps courses short and focused. It caters for a population long conditioned to see university principally as a pathway to professional incomes. It has, above all, the virtue of familiarity. The transition from classroom to clinic seems the natural order of things. So why contemplate change? Because there are costs also to the Australian approach. A higher education system dominated by undergraduate study narrows what can be taught in the final years of school, as students must choose their subjects with an eye to desirable university courses. Undergraduate professional training limits the breadth available to university students. Even those in a double degree program must sacrifice a proportion of their non-specialist degree to accommodate professional accreditation requirements. And in an era when so many graduates aspire to work abroad for at least part of their career, Australian higher education sits awkwardly alongside the dominant international models of North America and Europe. In both, of course, undergraduate courses are broader, with most professional education provided at graduate level. Given Australian universities are kept afloat by income from international students, compatibility with global trends matters. These issues form the basis of a consultation process across the university during 2005, which was followed by the publication of a short strategy paper titled Growing Esteem, a paraphrase of the university's motto, Posterior Crescam Laude, to grow in the esteem of future generations. I should note in parenthesis that the use of growing as an intransitive verb raised eyebrows amongst the university's more enthusiastic grammarians. Growing esteem proposed that the purpose of a contemporary university is understood best through the metaphor of a triple helix, three tightly woven strands of research and teaching and engagement. We research to contribute to the sum of human knowledge. We teach to share knowledge with a new generation, and we connect with a wider community through knowledge transfer, those partnerships and public lectures and collections and museums and galleries by which a university engages with its many publics. Each strand of the helix reinforces the others. Growing Esteem offered ideas about these three fundamental commitments, but inevitably all public attention focused on those proposals around teaching. And here Growing Esteem proposed the most far-reaching change to course structures and curriculum in the university's history, indeed the single largest voluntary institutional change in Australian higher education. This would become known in time as the Melbourne Model. I should note that the term was not invented by the university. In fact, it was resisted, but by the Age newspaper. And for 6 months, it called it Melbourne Model, while we called it Growing Esteem. And eventually, we gave up and we started calling it the Melbourne Model, at which stage the Age newspaper started calling it the so-called Melbourne Model. The Melbourne Model involved two big changes. The first was to design afresh professional qualifications as master's level programs. And here the university adopted common practice in North America and the 3+2 approach adopted by Europe through the Bologna Declaration. The second and related change was to consolidate 96 existing undergraduate courses into just 6 undergraduate degrees. Undergraduate degrees would provide a firm foundation in the world of learning, with graduate study then offering intensive and rewarding specialist qualifications. Now, both changes, it's important to note, involve significant risk, since students may not welcome the loss of direct entry to a profession, nor the additional year required to complete an undergraduate and then a graduate program. Yet the university found the case sufficiently compelling. A 2-year cycle would provide an undergraduate program of quality with no precedent in this country. Students would then be older when choosing their professional degree, better able to handle the courses and the intensity of graduate course expected at graduate level. The Melbourne model began formally at the start of the 2008 academic year, a time of both celebration and anxiety. As we meet at the end of 2010, the first cohort of new generation students will soon complete their undergraduate degrees and by early next year begin graduate school. Designing these new professional programs has provided an opportunity to think from first principles about the purpose of university education. For the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, the shift to a graduate approach has allowed a new clinical model, classes held in schools, supervision by master's teachers, in much the same way that many health professionals are taught. The Melbourne School of Law introduced its first graduate law program, the Juris Doctor, in 2000, but started again from the beginning of the Melbourne model 8 years later. Drawing on international experience, the law school capped classes at 60 students and emphasised cohort learning through group-based shared assessment assignments and spaces to work together outside class. In turn, the JD attracts students who expect to be challenged, are keen to learn, and many already hold postgraduate qualifications. Entry through the International Law School Admission Test ensures rigour in the selection of students and allows direct comparison between the Melbourne cohort and those internationally. Students arrive at this course expecting the highest level of teaching. And I recall speaking with enthusiasm with 2 law lecturers after the first year of the program at the end of 2008. And they describe it as the hardest work of their professional lives and easily the most rewarding. Early evidence suggests that a graduate approach has produced a more diverse group of students at the University of Melbourne. This is not surprising. Breaking the link between Year 12 results and the professions provides greater opportunity for students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds because underlying ability shines through undergraduate study and can inform graduate entry. However, though graduate entry may be more equitable, the Melbourne model does add in a year to university study, and this has cost implications for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. Hence, it was very important that the model included federal permission to offer Commonwealth-supported places in graduate schools, and we've been fortunate that both sides of politics supported the transition. We are even more fortunate that the accumulated endowment of the university could allow a significant expansion of scholarships and bursaries to students in need. We make choices by deciding what to rule out. There is no single best way to provide a university education. Even the basic approach of 3+2 can be delivered and structured in many different ways. For example, the Melbourne model is often, though inaccurately, described as a United States-style general liberal arts degree. This was indeed an option that was considered, but it was eliminated for a number of reasons. Undergraduate study in the United States and Canada is a 4-year program, while American arts and science degrees are of 3 years duration. That extra year of study allows North American students to balance breadth subjects with an extended major in their area of interest. In designing the Melbourne model, we could not replicate the same balance of breadth and depth in only 3 years of study. Hence, some measure of initial specialisation is required. And that's why we went for 6 undergraduate degrees: arts, biomedicine, commerce, environments, music, and science. Though Melbourne did not adopt a single liberal arts degree for all students, the model does draw on North American practice of breadth as part of every undergraduate program. This encourages students to experience new ways of thinking about the world. One unexpected result of this breadth requirement has been a sharp uptake in the study of languages at Melbourne, an increase of nearly 60% in the number of undergraduates studying a foreign language, with striking growth in enrolments for Japanese, French, Chinese, and Spanish. Brett has also encouraged teams of academics to collaborate on big projects, cross-disciplinary subjects around the challenges facing humanity. In 2011, for example, some 26 University Brett subjects will be offered to undergraduates, from food for a healthy planet through to the poetics of the body. These are subjects exploring race and social justice. There are subjects dealing critical thinking about data, an ecological history of humanity, for example, journeys through 150,000 years of human experience, the Great Migrations, health and disease, famine and plenty, war and peace, scientific and technological advance. And so we finished 2010 with our first cohort under the Melbourne model, poised to complete their undergraduate study and a new world of graduate study beckoning. But all this is already old news, so why tell the story again? Because the inspiration for the Melbourne model fits into a broader concern about diversity. In higher education, Australians have long preferred uniformity. 37 public universities, all with similar profiles, teaching approaches, and funding models. This has the merit of ensuring consistency across the sector and an easy choice for students. Since every institution is fundamentally the same, it's little wonder that so few Australians will travel interstate even to go to university. This tendency to sameness runs deep in this sector. We have conditioned the Australian public to a single model of what it means to be a university. The price of such standardisation is loss of choice. Regardless of the institution they select, students get offered essentially the same education philosophy through courses with very similar curricula and outcomes. Everything happens within the same inherited framework of undergraduate study. Growing Esteem offers a vision for a distinctive contribution to research, to teaching, and to engagement, binding these three together as a mission. It does what all universities must: chart their own future based on a distinctive vision about how knowledge should be organised and shared. The Melbourne model seeks to provide a meaningful choice to students interested in a broader education before they commit to challenging professional studies. The university has always accepted that the model will not appeal to everyone. Some students are wedded to undergraduate double degrees, others only want to study veterinary science or engineering and reject the prospect of a broader education. These reflect long-standing Australian practice and they must be respected. But for students who will accept the risk, the rewards are great. In the quality of education on offer, in the rigorous and intense enthusiasm of the graduate programs. University is all I hoped it would be, said one second-year environment student recently, talking to colleagues and I, as she weighed up whether to do the Masters of Architecture she thought she'd come to university to do, or pursued her newfound interest in urban planning. This is a story told in every faculty, in every course, as students spend their 3 years learning what it is that really excites them and then make choices based on that. The signs are encouraging. On all of our standard indicators, the Melbourne model has found a willing audience. Demand for new generation degrees is strong, entry scores are the highest in our history, and retention amongst new generation students is the best on record. And if imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, a number of institutions in Australia and overseas have adopted the Melbourne model in part or whole. Last year, Parkville hosted over 600 delegations from other universities wanting to look at what's happening. Yet it seems to me much too early to judge whether the Melbourne model will achieve its ambitions. The transformation to a long-term profile of half undergraduate and half graduate students will not be complete until 2014. And even then, several cohorts of students must complete the journey from new generation degree to graduate school before the patterns will become clear about employment or student satisfaction outcomes. And an important test will be whether the innovation survives a change of institutional leadership. A new management must eventually consider dispassionately whether the benefits of the Melbourne model justify its continuation. In any case, much will change between now and then. Major shifts in strategy may be rare, but incrementalism moves amongst us always. The specific degree titles and subject areas chosen back in 2006 will not remain appropriate forever. In time, the university may decide to continue consolidation, taking its 6 undergraduate degrees to just 1 or 2, as some already argue. There are others who are now arguing it's time to move from a 3 to a 4-year undergraduate degree, and these are debates we need to have. Likewise, the number of graduate programs will expand and contract in response to the wider world. Research too will create new areas of professional study. And hopefully, change in one institution encourages others to offer their own preferred mode of delivery, different degree structures, contending philosophies of education. We serve our nation best through competition of approaches. There need be no clear winner. Only recognition from diversity arises innovation. The experience of growing esteem, as so much in the early history of this institution, shows that a university can decide to strike out in new directions, to challenge its own origins. In the nature of such experiments, not everything works, choice is risky. But if we are to escape the bonds of our history and to touch greatness, we must be willing to try. How else can we grow in the esteem of future generations? Thank you.
Outstanding oration and explaining with clarity, amongst other matters, what is the university of today, where does it come from, and more specifically, the evolution in education at this university, leading under his leadership and his instigation to the modern model. I add, after having been processed through the proper governance channels, and its operation today and its future. I now invite Robert Menzies, who is representing the Menzies family, to present the commemorative medal to Professor Davis. Hopefully we'll avoid the best.